Welcome to another episode of the Disciple Making Leader Podcast. I'm your host today, Ben Borgman, the Executive Director of Disciple First. Our organization is just passionate about helping you make and multiply disciples like Jesus. And we're on this podcast today. This is part three of a series. We've been really looking into Lifeway Research, a study that they put out called The State of Discipleship. And I've got our faithful friends and contributors here with us, Pastor Glenn Underhill.
Yep.
How are you doing today?
Yeah.
All good. My brother.
Yep. Craig.
Hey.
Is your Topo Chico still cold?
It's wonderful.
We've been recording it's a little fantastic. While now.
I've just been nursing it, you know. Okay. I think I can get it through this.
We don't
episode.
Need lukewarm Topo Chico.
No, we're good to go, brother. We're good to go.
And if this is your first time joining the Disciple Making Leader podcast, go back, catch up. We're in the middle of season four. Really, we kind of kicked it off. Shared some live episodes that we recorded through our event called The Collective last year. And now we're in this three-part episode about the state of discipleship. So really just go back, get caught up. And the purpose of this podcast really is to be an encouragement to you, to highlight maybe some challenges that we all face as leaders and disciple-making leaders, and just really lift up the model of Jesus. And that's what we hope, and we hope it's an encouragement to you. So thanks for being on today. So let's get right to it, guys. I want to look at one of these kind of these major statistics that we've talked about in an earlier episode. I want to bring that out, but really work towards a resolution. Like, how, okay, this is an issue, and we could just leave it there and say, oh, that's an issue. But I really want to help people, because I think this is a common place that if I'm coaching pastors and leaders, this is the common place I meet pastors. Okay, I understand I need to make disciples. I want to live out the Great Commission. I just don't know what that looks like in the life of a church. Yeah. I've gone to seminary. I've done these things. I just don't know fundamentally, practically, blocking and tackling, how does this actually live itself out in the life of a local church? And so really where we're getting this from, this stat that we're discussing, it's half of pastors are satisfied with discipleship in their church. Exactly 52% based on the study. But most have no way of knowing it's actually happening. And really where we're going with this is the thinking is you don't know that it's not happening because, number one, you haven't defined success. You don't know what you're trying to produce or what is the outcome, what would success look like, and you don't know how to get there. That's basically, if we were to boil it down, that's the problem that I believe that is being expressed here. And again, that's where we're meeting pastors. And what we would say is that let's go back to the life of Jesus. Jesus had a clear end in mind when he engaged his first followers. He knew where he was going to take them. We could talk around it. We're not going to beat around the bush on that today, but really you go to Matthew 4:18-19. And I believe he knew what he was going to, he said, I'm going to follow me and I will make you fishers of men. He knew the end in mind from the beginning. And so I think that's clear for us, or I think it's critical for us as leaders to have that end in mind. And that end would be a disciple, right? If we're called to make disciples, wouldn't it be important to know what a disciple is? Mm-hmm. And so for you guys, how did you come up with your definition of disciple?
Yeah, you know, as you were talking about, pastors don't know how this fits in the local church. My mind was going back to Glenn, you and I, gosh, we've been together a long time. Remember when we were way back in Oklahoma and we were asking that very same question?
We were.
I mean, we had seen a very clear disciple-making process in the parachurch world, mm-hmm. right? We saw with Navigators, with Crusade, and others, but we had we'd never really seen it in the context of a local church.
And you know, the funny part is, Craig, is we had some men in our church in Oklahoma City who were part of parachurch ministry,
yes. yeah.
who were strong disciple-makers, who had had a huge influence in our life.
Big time.
But what we couldn't figure out, what the struggle was, how do we take what we're that and help put it into the context of a local church.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And that was a big question for us.
It was huge.
And we were banging and banging away at it. And we just, and at some point I remember feeling a little defeated, like, well, it just doesn't work in a church because we got deacons and we got programming and we've got all these, you know, and yeah. when you're a parachurch, you know, you don't have all that stuff. Right. Yeah. And so you can be much more lean and more focused. And I remember, and the shift in our thinking a lot came in this understanding that actually embedded in the life of Jesus was a pathway that could be applied in the local church. To me, that was kind of like the secret sauce or the key that opened this up for us, is discovering that Jesus actually had a pathway and the church could be adapted to live that pathway out.
Well, you know, and it was even as even after the discovery of the pathway for us that we just figured out, oh, fundamentally, he had a very clear picture of what he was trying to produce,
right?
Yeah. And that the pathway was what he was going to do to help produce that.
That's right.
Because we even struggled with that, if you remember. So we get the pathway, we figure out, oh, he's got this pathway, but we were like, oh, but how do you know if? So that's how you, that's making a disciple. But what is a disciple? And then when that is ultimately what led us to this idea that Jesus even could define what a disciple was.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, we banged on that quite a while.
Right.
And I just say all that to say if pastors are watching this podcast, man, we had to bang this stuff out. And we spent a lot of time on it, a lot of time working on it, trying to shape it out. We didn't know any other church that was doing it. Now, I'm not saying that there weren't other churches doing it. We just didn't know them.
Yeah.
Right.
And so we felt like we were a bit on an island trying to figure this out on our own. And so we can share with pastors, you know, hey, this is what we've learned, and you can build from there. But we had to start off with a clear definition of a disciple, and what we came up with, I'll just say it real clearly. If guys are involved with our ministry, they know this probably by heart. But a disciple is first someone who's devoted to Christ. That they are, we call it the three D's of disciple. They're devoted. That is, they've given their life to Christ. They've come to faith in Jesus, and they are devoted to Him. They are developing in the character and competencies of Jesus, meaning that they are developing and growing in some not only the character of Christ, what His heart, but also how He did certain things. You know, there are some skills, some competencies that you need to learn, like knowing how to read your Bible, understand that, knowing how to memorize Scripture, knowing how to share your faith. These are simple competencies that you can't multiply if you don't have those down.
Yeah.
Right?
Yep.
And then lastly was developing, deploy. This person is deployed into the mission of Christ, and they're multiplying their life in others.
Yeah.
Right? The end goal is multiplication. Mm-hmm. And so having that, and again, I remember the first time we worked on a definition of a disciple, we had like 32, you know, it was this long list. Yeah. And I remember us rolling this off with some of our leaders at our church, and their eyes just glazed over. I mean, we're young, we don't know what we're doing, but, and we're like, okay, that we got to shorten this thing up.
Yeah.
And so we just kept working and kept working and kept working. So that 3D sounds super simple, but it's got a lot of the components in there.
Yeah.
Of the type of person that is a fully trained, fully developed disciple.
Yeah.
Okay.
And that's critical because if you're going to build a house, you know what? Okay, is it a two-story house? Is it a one-story house? And that's going to dictate the process.
Right.
And that's what I love about, you know, about Jesus' model is when we, you know, part of this process and where we can start to unpack this is in the Great Commission where He's reminding His guys of, hey, go and make disciples. He's using a specific term there. They knew exactly what He meant when He was commanding them. And then He also reminds them of the process. And we'll kind of get into that. But I think that's the importance. Don't let your eyes glaze over when we start talking definitions. It is critical to do that. And that's, again, when we coach churches, that's where we begin.
Yeah.
Do your people understand, you know, do they have a picture? Do you have a picture of what you're trying to make? Because that will dictate your process. Because Jesus had a clear end in mind, so we should too. And then again, that will dictate how we get there. What do we need to do along the way? And you talk about not having clarity or is what I'm doing working? Well, if you have a definition, you can see is the activities that we're doing, are the groups we're doing, are the environments we're creating, are we seeing in this, like we'll use your term in a 3D definition, are these components of a disciple being produced in the life of our people?
Right.
That's that adds clarity. If you don't have it, you'll never know.
You know, Ben, one of the things I love to watch Glenn do when he trains leaders is he will ask guys, you know, what is a disciple? You know, you go through this exercise and I know what's coming, you know, I know because I've been through it enough, but it's interesting that, you know, you get somebody loves Jesus, somebody, I mean, we just get all these different kinds of responses, and they're none of them are in and of themselves bad, but they're very vague, right, and very general. And you watch the light come on a bit when guys begin to hone down. Okay, this is a picture of a fully trained and formed, mature disciple. They this is the core essence of it. Because now I do have a clear picture of what I'm trying to produce, what Jesus was trying to produce, right? Okay. And then I can back up and say, okay, how would we get to that? And so I just want to say that that's super critical.
Yeah. And to our listeners and viewers, if you go back to season one, and we'll put this in the show notes, we did a whole episode on on the definition of disciple. So we'll go into depth on that. You can also look in, it's all in our resources in Bold Moves and in other things where you can actually see what we're talking about. And again, we're always available for any questions. But the definition of success in a disciple is critical, but then again, because that dictates how we get there. So as you guys were forming this, as you were, you know, again, you talk back to Oklahoma and, hey, we know we need to do this, but what does this look like in the life of a church? And I already mentioned you can see this in the Great Commission, but that's not the only place you see this pathway lived out and see it expressed. Where, as you guys were discovering, what was emerging as you studied the life of Jesus?
With regard to the pathway?
With regard to his process, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, I think the big key for us is we started looking at the life of Christ and saying, is there a pattern here that Jesus is using? And I think that that's been difficult for years to see that, because when you look at just the Gospels in isolation, just Matthew, just Mark, whatever, it's not that clear.
Yeah,
and the reason why it's not that clear, because every gospel is arranged differently. You know, we know that Matthew is very thematic, you know, in his, how he put together his gospel. We know that that John was written the very last one that kind of fills in the time gaps. We know that Luke is more, the most probably chronological and has more time stamps in it than the others do. Mark is very concise and more action oriented. Then he did this. And so, if you just look at any one in isolation, you don't see it completely all together. There's this, you know, the movie that has Nicolas Cage in it where he's stealing the Declaration of Independence. You know,
National Treasure.
See, Glenn, we were just talking about movies. You've probably seen this line. And remember, there he gets these glasses that Ben Franklin put in some brick, you know, somewhere, you know, and then he clicks. And when he looks through all of those lenses, all of a sudden you can read the writing, right? And I think that's kind of like when you start to fit all the gospels together, then you begin to see something that you hadn't seen before, right? You begin to see a pattern in Jesus' life, an intentionality of what he's doing in stage one and phase two, phase three. And this really is the tool to help click all that together was studying through the harmony of the gospel. Yeah. And so we had a friend of ours that really challenged us to study the harmony. And I don't think up to that point I had ever really, I think maybe in seminary I got one required for a course and I had it stuck on my shelf. But we started devouring it and really going through it. And my harmony's got duct tape on it. It's, you know, trying to be held together, and it's definitely been used a lot.
Yeah.
But the harmony of the gospel is just a fascinating little side on that. In the first 3 to 5 centuries of the church, you saw an explosion of study on the harmony of the gospel. Tatian's Dia Tessaron is the first that we know of a harmony of the gospel, where he was trying to put Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John into some kind of contiguous narrative.
Mm-hmm.
This was the first one. This was like in 160, 175 AD. So this is early on. In the 3rd and 5th centuries, you have a couple of them. Eusebius has one, Eminus has one. And so you start to see kind of this work of trying to synchronize the harmonies together. But when you get from the 6th century to the 15th century, we're basically in the medieval period.
Mm-hmm.
There's very little work in it. If you were to graph it out, you would see some activity at the front end and then a long pause of no activity working on the harmony. And then you get basically in the 16th, 17th century where, you know, Calvin actually, you know, puts together some harmony. And then you see guys like Grisbach in 1776. you know, the birth of our country around that same time period. He has a gospel synopsis that was very popular. And so, and then it starts to increase again from there in the 19th century, 20th century now. Now that we're in the digital age, that can be done very easily.
Yeah.
And so you have now A.T. Robertson had one in 1922. You had Kirk Allen that had a synopsis of the four Gospels in 1963. And then the Thomas and Gundry one that we use a lot was in the 70s. And so what you're seeing now is this explosion or revisitation of what the early believers were really working on, which I thought was fascinating. You really got away from those in those earlier harmonies. These were guys that were now second or third generation believers, where the guys that were there passed away. And so they were harmonizing this to understand, you know, the life chronology of Jesus. And then it was lost in the medieval period for hundreds of years. And now are kind of being rediscovered through the Reformation period and up to today. And so I think sometimes when people say, "Well, what good is a harmony, and why have I not heard about this?" Mm-hmm. Blah, blah, blah. You know, well, there was a whole period in the church history where it was just not studied. But the value of the harmony is it allows you to see what Jesus was doing in one continuous pattern, right? And so what begins to emerge is Jesus was doing something in one stage, and then he was doing something in another stage, and doing something in another stage. And so you can look at the 3.5 so years of Jesus' ministry and begin to look at benchmarks and different shifts in what he was doing and why he was doing certain things. And it's just like the Ben Franklin goggles. All of a sudden now you can see a pattern and a pathway that Jesus used to turn irreligious men into multipliers and world changers.
Yeah.
And that is where the pathway that we're advocating comes from. It's not just, well, oh yeah, we have a pathway. We give and serve and go. And, you know, we're not just grabbing words.
Yeah.
You know, we're actually trying to articulate what was the path that Jesus took his, because we're fully convinced that Jesus was the best disciple maker ever. And that he is our model. You know, to follow me doesn't just mean follow in believing in me, but it also means to do what I did. If one claims to live in him, he must walk as Jesus walked.
Yeah.
And how can you walk as Jesus walked if you don't know how he walked, right? So this is what Glenn and I wrestled with, you know, early on.
Yeah, and I think, you know, as you say, it emerges. What's helpful to me is I was kind of discovering this, you know, working with you guys and just being a leader in the church, was you see from a chronological standpoint what Jesus did in each year, and these invitations kind of mark like these phases, right? Mm-hmm. But then when you start overlaying, as you go, make disciples of all nations, baptizing them, teaching them to obey all that I've commanded you. When we start to kind of, we start to break that apart and overlay, and it kind of follows the same pattern. And then I sit back and I start to go, well, okay, you're saying there's a time where people need to explore the claims of Christ. There's a time they need to be connected in the body. You're gonna, these are phrases that you're using to explain into context of a church. And then they need, there's a time to grow up and become a spiritual adult, and then to multiply. I started going, well, I can see my life at, I can remember when I walked through that stage, and then I can see when I was in a group and that happened and I connected, and then I was invited into this deal. And those layers, like you're saying, like the lenses, I was sitting there looking at these layers and I'm like, okay, I got it. You know, clear as bell. And so it made so much sense to me when I could add all those things together, kind of a logical person, but it just really made sense. Like, this is the way that we need, that people grow.
Yeah.
Like, God's the creator of all things. Doesn't he know how things grow? And he's a God of order and pattern. And, you know, things grow from a seed to a sapling to a tree, and then it bears fruit. Like, why do we think that's different when we go to spiritual formation?
Mm-hmm.
And so, again, so as we're talking about a pathway, you've defined, Craig, you've defined a spiritual pathway, a disciple-making pathway, as Jesus' strategic plan to make multiplying disciples and ignite a movement.
Right.
And it's this progression from, like you said, irreligious to movement builder.
Right.
And it's this idea of I'm exploring till I'm all the way through till I'm multiplying. Glenn, add some clarity. What are some things to know about a pathway that maybe people may have confusion? What are just some good things to know about what we mean by a spiritual pathway?
Yeah. So I think any spiritual pathway is going to have it's going to be kind of linear in its nature, meaning it's going to move from point A to point B, and, mm-hmm. and it's going to have a very succinct process. People would I've seen pathways where they're in a circle because everybody's journey is a little bit different, but I see it kind of in this idea that it really has a linear process. I think another thing too is that it definitely has a very much of a supernatural work of God.
Oh yeah, for sure.
In it, right, that it's not something that yes, we're involved in it and we're playing a big part of. I mean, we're playing a piece of it, but at the end of the day, it is a supernatural process.
Yeah.
Everybody who walks from one stage to the next stage to the next stage, it's not because of any magic formula or any magic mm-hmm. curriculum or because of any, this or that. It really is a supernatural work of God in an individual's life as they are making those progressive steps along the way. I think the last piece for me is that it's highly intentional,
mm-hmm.
meaning it really isn't just we're kind of shooting arrows and hoping that they land somewhere, and then we try to figure it. We're working with this intentional fortitude of focus of saying, hey, we're going to identify where you are, and then we have some clear next steps to help you move from one stage to the next and to the next to the next, because ultimately we want to get you to that place where you are a proven multiplier and that you are out being deployed into the mission of Jesus.
What would you say to the leader, maybe a skeptical leader that's hearing it for the first time, or like, okay, you're talking stages and you're saying this is linear. This sounds real robotic and programmatic. How is that really going to help me minister to people well?
Yeah, I'd just go back to Jesus.
Yeah.
I mean, Jesus changed the world, right? I mean, and as much as I might want to say that, and it's easy to throw a rock at that, I go back and say it's what Jesus did. And if Jesus changed the world with 12 men who we're told as a result of what was going on in their lives and then them reproducing who they were and the others, it says in Acts 19 that they turned the world upside down.
Yeah.
They were world changers. I am amazed sometimes. I read Acts 19 and it says that every household, known household had the gospel. I mean, that's mind blowing to me. We can't say that today.
No.
And I think, wow, in a short period of time, it radically impacted the world, 28 years. I mean, after Jesus' ascension, I mean, they were able to say that of those guys, that they had turned the world upside down, 28 years.
Yeah.
And it's because multiplication was the mark, but it was linear, yeah. It was supernatural, and it was intentional, yeah. And they were just replicating what Jesus did. And that's all I'm saying is it's not about what we're saying here. This is how Jesus did it.
Mm-hmm.
And that's how I guess I would answer that.
One thing I would just kind of tack on to that, Glenn, and I've heard you say this multiple times, is in all that, it was about relationship. You know, mm-hmm. that Jesus was really good at relationally investing in these people. So if somebody's saying, well, this is too chop, 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 that's not, Jesus was highly relational with his guys.
Mm-hmm.
And, I know that I've heard you talk about that piece a lot,
yeah.
That just how important that you're personally knowing them. And I could tell you that the times when, if there, is there room in here for confession?
Yeah. Okay. I'm not a priest though.
Okay. But
we know, a great high priest.
We do. Amen. Thank you, Jesus. I need help. The times when there have been times in my life when I've been very relational with the guys that I'm spending time with. And unfortunately, there are times I'm not. I've just been, okay, we have our meeting, we go through our thing, and I look back at those and see that, it was at times that I really invested in my life relationally, mm-hmm. outside the time of our meeting and having these sidebar conversations, wrestling with, the things they're dealing with at home or whatever, that really you start to see their growth come alive.
Yeah.
And, And so I just would say, you know, as you know, if somebody's saying it's too robotic, you know, then you've got to be sure that you're inserting your real love and care for them.
Yeah.
You know, in the process.
And that's, you know, Jesus was extremely strategic, but he was also highly relational.
Yeah.
And so, and again, it, from experiencing the system, the pathway as it exists in real time here at Cross Creek, you never feel like it's a program. You never feel a part of a program. Okay, I'm going to complete step one, step two, step three. It's very relational. And I believe people move through the process via relational invitations. Mm-hmm. Yes, you have environments and programming and studies and things that are designed, but I love how you communicate it that our programming is just how we organize relationships. That's this undergirding. I think some people, maybe on the surface, they kind of may dismiss it. They don't really understand until we have some further conversations with them is that no, this is highly relational. That's actually how you get people to move, is because you're going deeper in relationship and you're developing trust, and then you invite them forward just like Jesus did. You're not just creating these things. I think this is a tendency that I see, like as I'm observing, I'll check out XYZ church and they may have what they would think is a pathway or maybe communicated or displayed like a pathway, but it's not really this progressive, I'm building something to a specific end. It becomes more these categories of activity.
Yeah.
And I think that's what we need to, it looks like a pathway, but it's really not, because based on the definition, you're moving someone to becoming a multiplying trained disciple, not just these categories of intention. Mm-hmm. And I think it's kind of a little bit of shift. We have to reprogram some people that we're mm-hmm. coaching sometimes, is you're not just creating categories of activity. Mm-hmm. That's not what we're doing. This is a map. This is a pathway to an end, you know. And I think that's really the main benefit. Glenn, I'd love for you to share kind of the phrase you always like to say when we're talking to churches about, hey, you have these programming categories and you need to move away from that. What do you tell them?
Yeah, you know, I often talk about this idea of going into a, because I love food, and if it were candy all the time, it'd be better. But I, you know, you go into like my fate. So, you know, just confessing, we're on that road, right? I love Chinese buffet, right? And there's nothing more glorious than a Chinese buffet. And you show up and you get there and you're like, wow, this is amazing. Look at all these wonderful things. And you struggle. Or I'm like, let's just say you go to Chili's or you go anywhere, right? You show up and they put a menu in your hand. And my wife, she struggles because there's so many things on there. She's got to, you know, what do I want? Do I want meat, or do I want a steak tonight, or do I want a burger, or do I want? And so, you know, it's just all these different things. And then you're just kind of picking and choosing along the way. And that is what we do in church, I think, is we just kind of say pick and choose along the menu of life that will help maybe get you to where you need to be. But I don't see that as a part of what Jesus was doing. And that's what I like to say, is that Jesus didn't provide a menu. He provided a map mm-hmm. that moved people from being irreligious to becoming fully trained, capable of changing and reaching the world and being a part of the mission. So that is so easy for me to hold on to, because it's like, yeah, I think in the church we've just done a great job of either the buffet or just the map, and we just, or menu, I'm sorry, and we just kind of offer all these things and they pick and choose along the way. Mm-hmm. And then a lot of times what people will say is like, oh, I've hit it all and it's, you know, and I'll go on to the next place and hit there. And that's what we see happen a lot in churches, is they go from one church to the next church to the next church because they've tapped through the whole menu.
Yeah, and the preference. And they, you know, and I think they do it all or they do nothing. Sometimes it's overwhelming. You got six women's Bible study. Well, which one do I do? What do I need to do? Right. And that's the importance, is clarity.
You know, as you were giving that illustration, it made me think about a gym. You know, like you go to a big Planet Fitness or something like that, you know, and you can come in, you can do a little thing over here, do a little thing over there, and sit in the relaxed chair, you know, mm-hmm. whatever. Yeah. And then you can leave, you know, you did a little bit of stuff, but you're not in any progression that's going to help you get any better. But if you actually went to a trainer that said, okay, we're going to customize something for you. You got to deal with your diet. You got to deal with your exercise. You're going to have to work on your cardio, and we're going to get you to here through this process if you'll stick with me. That's a whole different process.
Yeah.
So I think a lot of times that's another illustration of churches, you know, I do a little of this, I do a little of that, but I'm not really moving forward. Yeah. And really the report indicated that people were not that interested in disciple making issues sometimes. And I think, as Glenn pointed out in a previous episode, it's because, you know, they've said, I've been there, done that.
Yeah.
I did a little of this, I did a little of that, and didn't really do much good for me. And so I'm moving on to other things.
Yeah, and I think, you know, going back to the one, this kind of stat that we started with was they, you know, most have no way of knowing if it's actually happening. And again, back to the point of us talking about a pathway, when you provide a map to an end, now all of a sudden there's clarity. Right. Now all of a sudden I know by watching someone move down the pathway, identifying, hey, where are you? And again, coaching conversations. Hey, where do you see yourself in this pathway? Well, I've accepted Jesus as my Lord and Savior. I'm trying to follow Him. I'm connected to a group. Okay, well, you're right here. Well, here's, so you know there's progress. Now you know that something you're doing is moving people to that point, or you're able to measure effectiveness. And then, but you're also with the person, you're able to say, well, here's your next step.
Yep.
And it gives clarity, and it provides that measure of here's where you are and how do you move forward. Yep. And I think that's one of the critical things. What other benefits do you see when you actually have a pathway implemented? What are some other benefits in the life of a church as a church leader do you see?
I think it brings incredible alignment when you have a pathway, right? Mm-hmm. Because you're able to move your ministries towards being aligned to that pathway. They're all helping to move towards it, not hopefully not kind of offshoots here and there, going anywhere and everywhere. But it's all hopefully it's this aligning towards that pathway, which then brings even more synergy, and more movement in that. Mm-hmm. For sure.
Yeah, that's a good point. And I've seen you do that in your role. You have to align multiple departments to all be working on the same. And there's a lot of power in that. I think another thing, too, is the pathway becomes a good evaluative tool to say, are we balanced in every one of these stages? You know, are we only focused over here and we're not doing much over here? And so it provides a good tool to evaluate and make sure that you're what you are providing is balance and actually helping people move through the process. And also, where are people getting stuck? You know, where are they dropping out? Where is it a struggle? Maybe we need to zoom in here and figure out how to improve that a little bit better. Maybe we're just not offering it right or not communicating right.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Accurately and effectively. And I think, too, it also allows a church to, as you're saying, when they're evaluating, they're able to say, you know, maybe this next year we need to, because we've seen a surge of new people put their trust and faith in Jesus Christ, we need to maybe this year really lean a little bit more heavily on some things that are those next steps to assimilating these believers into the church, or whatever that might be. It adds a tremendous amount of help.
Yeah.
To leaders as they're looking at their calendaring and their activities and their programming, as well as their budget dollars.
Yeah, no doubt, no doubt.
Yeah, Craig, what else do you think?
You know, I just think from a personal standpoint, when you know where you're trying to take people as a shepherd, you feel like that you're. You celebrate when you see people get to a certain state. It's kind of like when when you're raising your kids, there's certain celebration milestones, right? When they graduate from high school or graduate from college or they get married or they have kids, you know, those are all when they left the house and you're empty nester.
Yeah.
You don't know about that.
You get a raise.
That's right. You know, there are these milestone moments, right? Without a pathway, you don't have those milestone moments. You can't really stop and celebrate those things. And, but when you do, you can see, you know, I was thinking about, you know, there was a group of guys that I discipled. We were actually wrapping up during COVID. So we had to do the last little bit of it, like virtually, because of the obvious reasons. And I didn't really hear much about, but this one of the guys in that group, he led a couple other groups, and one of the guys in his group started growing and multiplying, and then he had this connection in Nepal, and now we're seeing this whole multiplication movement happening in Nepal. And I went to the guy that I discipled that discipled him, and I said, "Man, that's your fruit."
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And he looked at me kind of strange for a minute. I said, "No, that's, man, you have a hand in that. God used you. Look at how God used you." And it was like his eyes lit up, and it was like for the first time he saw, "Man, I'm truly living a fruitful life as a result of this."
Yeah.
And he was very humbled by that. Mm-hmm. And I said, "Next time we go, we got to all go together, you know, and just celebrate that." Yeah. I think when you don't have a pathway, you miss these moments of celebration along the way.
And that progress is inspiring and encouraging to keep people to go through and reinvigorating. And as a, you know, even just from a church communication standpoint, it's, those are stories you can tell to get other people engaged and other people, you know, to continue on. So, and you don't have that if you haven't had that laid out.
And I think for me, a real value is, I mean, in ministry, there's just moments of frustration, right? You get an email of someone who's upset or family that's leaving the church or whatever along the way. But when you can see things like real, I can go home at night knowing, hey, in spite of this issue, man, God's doing some really great things. And you can point to how God's moving transformationally. But if you're not seeing that, I mean, and then you get in all these tough emails about this or that or critical over this preference or that preference or whatever. You're like, man, I'm out. I'm going to go sell Subarus. Right? So I think
we shared that with everybody a few episodes ago. We shared your Subaru salesman.
So I just am like, man, it's what keeps me in the game. And I remember early in ministry, and we were struggling through all of this. There were times I was like, man, I don't know if this is what I want to keep, because I'm just not seeing people's lives really being changed. And I signed up to I wanted to see that happen. I wanted to see people really changed and transformed by Jesus. Yeah. It is what keeps me in the game.
Yep. Yeah, I just think about that passage in, what was it, 1 Thessalonians, where he said, you know, you are my joy, you are my crown, you know, and you're my celebration, you know, and there's that joy of the father, you know, spiritual father that is poured into his spiritual children, and they're bearing fruit. You know, John said, "I have no greater joy than to see my children walking in truth." And he's talking about his spiritual kids. Mm-hmm. And, you know, as a pastor, without a pathway, you can so easily get discouraged and you miss out on the moments of celebration along the way.
Yeah. And I think, you know, so again, this is where we meet a lot of our pastors and leaders in coaching. We meet them right here at the definition of disciple and a pathway. It's not present, but they know they need it, and we start working on that. So, but for our listeners, Craig, I want to start developing this, thinking about this, what would you tell a kind of a pastor that doesn't have a pathway that they really, what do they need to do to start to develop one?
Yeah. So a couple of things that we did, you know, we started studying the life of Christ. So we dug into the harmony of the gospel. I mean, honestly, if I were just talking to a pastor and he said, "What's one thing I could start to do right now?" I would just, man, if you were reading through the harmony, you start to get a feel for what did Jesus do. And then, what we did is we started looking at the harmony. Then we started identifying these major pivot points, and we can show you what we've come up with, but you may want to slice it a little differently. It's interesting that, I call it kind of like the salami, you know, and sometimes you can cut the salami in different spaces. And so we have Dan Spader, one of our dear friends and mentors, the guys that invested in us so much. You know, he slices it one way, and Bill Hull slices it a little different way. We slice it a little bit. You know, it doesn't really matter. It's all still the same process, right? But in getting informed of the life of Jesus, understanding his way. In fact, we have a book called His Way Still Works. It identifies the 36 key events in the life of Jesus. That might be just a good primer to get you started. You know, instead of just tackling the harmony all by yourself, you know, this would kind of show you some of these key events in the life of Christ chronologically. But then we identify what were the key steps along the way, and then we hardwire, okay, here is the pathway. Here are the phase one, here's phase two, here's phase three, based on the life of Jesus. And then we start to evaluate, okay, what are we doing as a church, and where would it fit? You know, now a lot of times you're tempted to say, well, we do worship and that's all of them. Yeah, we do all this in worship. And we're like, no, you don't. You know, you have to identify one primary purpose for every event that you do.
Yeah.
And then start to plot that along this map that Jesus has given us. And then it really becomes pretty eye-opening, right, as to where the gaps are, where you're overly programmed in. We could probably guess, you know, that everyone's probably jammed up in the connect phase, which is very common. And then what would it look like for us to start to add into this? That's what we did here. You know, we just kind of plotted out there. What do we need to add? What do we need to take away from? And over time, you start to balance this out where you're starting to see movement through this pathway, identifying tools along the way that can help you develop people at each stage. This is basically how you've put a pathway to work.
Yeah.
But just coming up with four words that you want to hang on a banner, that's not going to do you a whole lot of good.
Right.
But when it's really start to embed it into what you're doing and evaluating it and programming toward that, it can be very effective.
Yeah. And I think it's what I've seen in helping leaders make this change and say, what does this look like in your context? There's so much confidence that comes from that work. Now, again, I think you said it in Bold Moves. Your quote is, you know, people in churches are like people in a planes. They don't like sudden moves.
Right.
So what we're not advocating is you evaluate your program and you say, hey, we know this event, this program is not being, you know, beneficial. So we just need to kill it. That's not what we're saying. You know, there is a bit of a savviness with change management. Right. And again, if we can walk you through some of those things, but this is a little bit of a, okay, You got to know where you are before you can know where you're headed. But I would say that's kind of a slower process. But I think it's something that's worth it because I've seen leaders just their response when they start to get things in position and they start to see people moving through, then they're like, okay, this is actually worth the effort. Mm-hmm. This is worth it, you know, taking the time to think about this. But again, we have people that are resistant too, you know, like, well, you know, I've tried that before. That won't ever work here. What would you say to somebody like, this won't ever work in my church? My church is small. That, you know, this type of strategic thought or this type of pathway would never work for us. What would you say to them?
I just encourage them to maybe get in front of the Lord and just say, okay, Jesus, how did you intend the church to be? Mm-hmm. What was your heart behind the church? And do I need to have a change of heart? Because oftentimes excuses are more based out of fear, mm-hmm. or they come out of, I don't want to make some of the hard moves. Mm-hmm. Oftentimes, and I'm not going to say this all the time, but I have found that, you know, it just there's a real fear to change, and because change brings disruption and oftentimes conflict. And I think just by and large, I think people get kind of adverse to conflict, right? And so there's a little bit of fear of that.
Oh,
and
yeah.
I think that, you know, that often is what brings up those things and triggers it, and especially if they've had change in the past and it hasn't gone well. So I'd just say, hey, I encourage, you know, just get in front of them and ask the Lord, and really, truly ask the Lord.
Mm-hmm.
Because I believe Jesus's model, whether you're a church of 10 or whether you're a church of 100,000, the principles still work no matter the size, the location, the context, because the principles are biblical and they are following the model of Jesus.
Yeah.
You know, what's fascinating, you said that so well, we're seeing this, and right now it applied in our Cross Creek network where we're planting churches.
Mm-hmm.
And we have churches in rural Africa. We have churches in metropolitan places like Montreal and New York City and the West Coast. We have churches, you know, all kinds of churches in Cambodia. My point is that this pathway operates effectively in any culture, in any language, because it's not based on buildings or band or things like that. It's based on the strategy of how Jesus brought change and multiplication. And so it's the genius yeah. of Jesus, right?
Yeah.
It is the simplicity of it and the power of it that God uses in any context, small, large, no matter what culture you're in, that God uses to grow his church.
Yeah, that's honestly, it's one of the most exciting things I get to do is, and it really gives me confidence in when we're out working with churches across the world, we're not saying, hey, you need to be like Cross Creek.
Right.
That's not what we're saying. No. We're looking at the life of Jesus and look at his model still works. His model, his way is still relevant and it can work in your context. And it's just different timing, different scale, different context. That's all, I mean, but it still works. And to me, that's exciting that I'm advocating for it. It's just fun. To me, it's fun. It's like putting together a puzzle. You're looking at this place and it is completely different than Colleyville, Texas.
Right.
And, but I know that can still work there and let's figure it out.
Yeah.
And that's, I really have fun doing that and working with pastors and helping them figure out what that is. And we've seen it in small contexts, yeah. in larger contexts. This year, I've worked with small cowboy church in more rural Texas that, you know, that in that context, we've also worked in large churches bigger than Cross Creek in El Paso, Texas.
Right.
Completely different, same result, same positive. You're starting to see life breathe in. You're starting to see people being invested in. You're starting to see people multiply. And you're seeing a leader that now has a little bit more positive outlook on ministry and is excited about ministry again.
Yeah.
And so once you have this up, I want to wrap up with this, but maybe what are some challenges you have seen as a leader? You have the pathway established because the work's not over. It's not a set it and forget it, right? You know, making disciples that you create this system, this pathway, you implement it. The work's not necessarily done. What are some of the main challenges you see now that you have it up and running? I mean, you've been here for 18 years, Craig. I know it wasn't always visible, you know,
right.
for all those years. There was some underground work that had to be done. But now that it's done, what are some of the challenges you see even with it done?
Yeah, you know, I think there's always a challenge of balance. You know, sometimes, you know, if you don't stay on it, you know, then things get away from you. And I think we have to constantly are saying, are we well balanced in every
yep.
one of these phases? That's one. I think there's a challenge of that Glenn mentioned earlier, and that is just, hey, when you do have to make a hard call on a programmatic situation, mm-hmm. that not everybody's going to like that.
Yeah.
Now we've learned some things about how to do that where it doesn't kill your church or get you on the unemployment list. There are some ways we learned just from our own mistakes, you know, if nothing else, don't do it like this, you know, and we've learned some of those things. But those are always challenges. We found, though, that the more consistent we are, rooted in the life of Jesus,
mm-hmm.
that people learn to trust you more and more and more
yeah.
with those things.
Yeah.
I think sometimes one thing we did one time was we put the pathway out there and we had everybody self-diagnose where they were supposed to be on it. And everybody diagnosed themselves much further down the pathway than what they really were.
Mm-hmm.
And so we kind of learned, well, that's not always that helpful, too. Mm-hmm. Because they kind of had a false sense of self maturity, you know, or some of them just got upset, you know, because we said, here are some practices if you're in this, and they just got mad because they weren't hitting that. I think they were just being convicted, you know, but, you know, so it's a challenge to help people to realize that, you know, this is just this is a map, you know, that Jesus has for you. I think it's a challenge to keep it out in front of your people.
Yeah.
You don't want to do it too much. They're like, okay, blah, blah, blah. They've heard this too much, but you can't do it not enough that people kind of forget about it. I think honestly, where we need to be, and I say need to be because I think we're always need to improve. We just got to keep it in front of our leaders more and more and more and more and more. Because the leaders need to understand this.
Yeah.
You know, the average rank and file person that comes and goes, you know, they're just trying to figure out where they're at, you know, what they need to do. But the leader should understand why we're this way, how we staff this way, how do we make decisions this way, what problems we're facing in result of this. And it gives them great confidence, too. Mm-hmm. I mean, it brings a lot of unity around the leadership that, hey, this is what we're doing.
Yeah.
I think if I went into our leadership meeting on you know, tomorrow and said, we're not going to do the pathway anymore, they'd run me out of town, you know? And that's good. They should, because this is in their blood.
Yeah. Glenn, one of the more common challenges I hear from a lot of people or that have been maybe working at this for a while, and I think you can maybe speak into it, is keeping people multipliers, people that have multiplied, how do you keep them hot-hearted in the game, because that's frustrated? What ways have you tried to tackle that? Because I know y'all have dealt with the same issue.
Yeah, I mean, so we've tried many different approaches. I think one of the greatest ways is making sure, and I'm going to use a word just because it helps to kind of bring some clarity. So my downline, so to speak, right? Mm-hmm. Making sure I'm keeping up with several of these guys, and just saying, hey, how are you coming? Like, the man that discipled me calls me every month, right? And he's been doing that for a long, long time. And, just ask me, how are your guys? What's God teaching you, right? So I think that's one way. I think we use gatherings, we multiplying gatherings where we're really trying to agitate, and to keep that out in front and create new learnings and new skills and keep casting vision for them to see how God's working and what he's doing. I think that's, another fabulous method is doing those periodically. And then, again, sharing stories of how God is using the process to bring about life change.
Yeah, I think that's a powerful
And I think that those stories go a long way to keeping people moving forward in it. And truthfully for me, I got a group of guys I meet with on Monday mornings, and Monday mornings is one of my favorite times. It's early, but it's one of my favorite times of the day or during the week. And they bring a lot of inspiration to me.
Yeah.
When I can watch what God's doing in their life, when I can see, wheels turning, when I can see conviction happening in their life, when I hear what God's teaching them, and there's something about that just grabs me and makes me go, I want to keep doing this. I want to keep, keep getting better at it.
Yeah. And it keeps you in the game too.
Right.
And it's almost like, it's like in any relationship, there's this cyclical approach. When you give, you get. When, as you're pouring your life in to them and they're benefiting from that investment, you're also benefiting. And then me as a leader, as kind of a co-laborer with you, we're leading together in different avenues. I'm watching you live that out, and that's holding me accountable to be invested in my guys, because I want to be able to share those same stories that, hey, I just invited these guys into a group and we're starting to do this. And it just creates this environment that keeps us all moving in forward. And that, again, it begins, back to your point, Craig, it begins with leadership modeling it. Yeah. Leadership has to get it and live it, or it's not going to work.
That's right.
And so, again, I thank you both. Number one, I thank you for going through the hard work of putting all this into place here at Cross Creek, because I've benefited from it, and hundreds of other people that I know have benefited from that. God has used your hard work and as you partnered with him to really have true life transformation in the lives of people here. So I thank you for that. Thank you for what you do to help us with Disciple First, really encourage and equip leaders to make and multiply disciples like Jesus. And just I genuinely appreciate both of you. As you've been listening, guys, thank you so much for taking the time to join this podcast. And again, we've been going through this Lifeway study, Lifeway research on the state of discipleship, and we have a link for you in the show notes on that. But again, what we really want to do is connect with you. We also have a way that you can reach out to us about coaching. And really, coaching for us is just a conversation to see how we can help you, not this programmatic, hey, this is a one stop in a box for everybody. It's really adaptive and really personalized to you and your needs. So I'd love to have a conversation with you about how we can help you make and multiply disciples like Jesus. Thanks for listening.